Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. Joining me as always is my co-host and partner in crime, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Hi Elwood, I'm Lackey, look at me!
If you didn't obviously listen to our previous episode or guess on Lackey's impression, we are going to be looking at Rick and Morty this week as we check out the episode Me, Six and Destroy from Season 1. We're also going to be looking at an episode from the reboot of The Outer Limits, from Season 1, Episode 15, The New Breed, a.k.a. the Nanobots episode. But before we obviously get into our shows for this evening, we might as well start the show the way we always do, by asking what you've been watching. So, Lucky, what has been holding your interest since the previous episode?
Recently, I don't know if this is, I'm assuming this has come over to Netflix in Britain as well, but the big thing that everybody's talking about on the internet right now is Stranger Things.
I've heard it, but I've not actually sat down to watch it. I recently renewed my Netflix subscription, mainly because I was kind of bored of my wife just telling me there's nothing on TV on a Saturday night, because for some reason the bottom's fallen out of the TV schedule as there is nothing on, so we got it so we can watch Making a Murderer.
Because
she's a big true crime fan, and I basically wanted to watch Orange is the New Black Season 4, so I've sort of bit the bullet because I know how naff Netflix here in the UK compared to the States it is. So obviously a lot of people, as you said, a lot of people have been talking about that show, but yeah, I mean, what's sort of been appealing about it?
It's really kind of hard to put my finger on it, but it's something where it's got this very, very specific sort of 80s sort of vibe to it. Very much sort of like a Stephen King, you definitely, like Stephen King vibe to it. You can definitely tell, like, the influence of, like, where it, like, refers to specific things. Not just, like, Stephen King, but also, like, just, you know, influences as diverse as Twin Peaks, Steven Spielberg's films. There's a lot of shots and relationships that explicitly, like, refer to, like, E.T. And then on the weirder end, there's also specific, like, I guess I was talking to Nick Job, of formerly of Your Face, and he was mentioning that he had, I think he or someone he knew, had seen, like, specific references to the anime Elfin Lied.
Wow.
That's
a good one.
Cronenberg references. I'm always a sucker for anything that's got weird science and exploding heads. It's a lot of fun. I don't know if I would say that it is, like, great, great at this point. I don't know if I would say it's great in the same way that I, you know, think that, you know, Hannibal was great or The Americans is great. But it's definitely on the level of some really, really kind of fun science fiction, horror, very atmospheric stuff like Fringe.
Okay.
Very enjoyable.
That's good too.
I do have to warn people that going into it, you do have to build up something. You do have to have something to be tolerant for Winona Ryder, doing Winona Ryder type things, because it really, I didn't really have much of a problem with it, but I was really in the, she basically spends about 8 straight episodes in a basic constant state of hysteria. And I actually kind of admire that. But there were points, I was telling Heather Baxendale this, about halfway through, that I was really beginning to wish that they'd hired an actress who could modulate her performance a little bit more.
Okay. I don't know what it is with Winona Ryder. I mean, she kind of hit on that sort of revival train around the time of Black Swan.
Right.
And I really liked her in Black Swan. I mean, I've never really had a problem with her. I didn't really, wasn't overly excited about her during, like, the height of her career. But the few bits and pieces I've seen of this sort of revival period for her, I've kind of been interested. I mean, I really like Black Swan. I was interested to obviously see her in this, even though I've obviously not watched it. So by the time we come to record this next episode, I could be like completely the opposite opinion of Winona Ryder.
Yeah.
And just like be absolutely sick of her. So as you said, it seems very Spielberg-esque. And it's one of those shows that everyone just wants to talk about at the moment. But I kind of have to give thanks to the internet that no one is wanting to spoil it at the moment, which
is
kind of a rarity. And I'm not sure it's the fact that we've all sort of bitched long and hard enough about people ruining things for each other that people are now sort of worked it into their psyche, then you know that, you know, if you see something that's going to be popular, don't be a jackass and ruin it for everyone.
Right. And I think the thing is that a lot of the people on my Facebook feed who have been really in love with, have fallen in love with Stranger Things are also a lot of the same people that I discuss Game of Thrones with. And one of the constant things we discuss in Game of Thrones was how, you know, with Game of Thrones, I don't have HBO. I don't have cable here. I mean, I can certainly get it if I want to, but it's an additional expense I don't want to deal with.
Yeah.
I would only ever watch like two shows on it, if that. And to me, it's not worth that expense. So kind of as a result, when it's on, when Game of Thrones is on, I don't watch it that Sunday night. I watch it on Thursday nights. I get together with a bunch of friends and watch it at a friend's house. And the trend had been that people were spoiling major plot issues and deaths within like 6 hours of the episodes airing. I would log on to Facebook in the morning and I would find out who died in the previous episode. And I can't use social media for, you know, 5 days. So I just basically started to the first thing I do, you know, when I had some time in the morning is basically look up the recaps and basically catch up on what I missed, you know, and then actually watch the episode later, you know. And that really, there are certain things that I think I really would have liked to have been surprised by, particularly in the season finale, that I thought that this, and I think we discussed this last episode where I thought that, and I will get eventually back to Stranger Things, I promise. Actually, I'll just get back to Stranger Things now because I've already said this previous episode.
Okay.
But yeah, it's so a lot of the people that I have, like I said, as a result of that, as a result of the discussions that, you know, we've had about why is it that, you know, it's certain shows like Game of Thrones, people want to go after a Game of Thrones episode and immediately want to go, holy shit, all these people died. And with this one, I think people are being a lot more cognizant. I mean, there's other reasons. I think reasons, not just that. Stranger Things, I think part of it with Game of Thrones is Game of Thrones is just so damn popular.
Yeah.
You know, it is like one of the, probably the most, that and like The Walking Dead seem to be the ones, the shows that people talk about the most on the internet. And I also kind of think, I think that Stranger Things hasn't quite hit that level yet. And it's only been on Netflix for like a little over a week. But also I think it's not as, holy shit, did you see that? As The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones tend to be. It's a dark show. It's got its twists and turns. It is not a show that I would say has that sort of that shock value. I don't know. I don't know what shows you might have had specifically problems with people spoiling that you've enjoyed.
I think Game of Thrones would be the only one. And I think because at the time I was working for Sky, so it was a case of that if I didn't watch it the night it was on, I know I'm going into the office the next day and someone's going to ruin it, or a customer who I'm going to speak to on the phone is going to ruin it. So it was sort of like inevitable. And I had this one customer while I was working there, and she was like, I know that someone's going to ruin Game of Thrones for me. Tell me everything that happened in Game of Thrones season 2. About 20 minutes. Like, going through it, and this is while I'm trying to explain it, and at the same time, the other Game of Thrones fans are there trying to, like, pass me post-it notes to give me, like, these ongoing corrections as I'm screwing stuff up, so... And I'm, like, thinking, there's so many characters, how do you, like, give some sort of plotting? So it's sort of like, okay, in this area, these things are happening, in this area, these things are happening, so...
It's, have you seen the Samuel L. Jackson brings you up to speed video on Game of Thrones?
I haven't.
It's hilarious. And even then, there's things that he has to skip.
Yeah, Game of Thrones, I mean, I've finally watched, since the previous episode, I finally watched the last episode of this previous season. I mean, for myself, I feel that the episode itself, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it felt in places that I was watching the episode in reverse, because we have this great, this huge grandstand moment that it opens with.
Right.
And then it sort of winds down towards the end. And for myself, I would have put that big grandstand moment as your final sort of shot.
Right.
And just like rejiggered it around a bit. But one of the characters, I'm not going to say which, deciding to off themselves.
Yeah.
That for me was, should have been the final shot of the season, but it's just used as a throwaway shot. And that's the only reason I'm sort of giving it away as a minor spoiler now. I just felt it was used as a very minor shot when it could have had much more impact had its placement been correct. But I enjoyed the final episode. I think it had a lot to follow on from, especially after the Battle of the Bastards.
Right, right.
And a lot of it felt like, okay, we're just sort of, we've had these major events, so we need to just basically move all these players into the new position so we can start the next season.
Right.
And at the same time, wrap up a couple of the bigger sort of plot lines. So we've obviously seen many key characters sort of rise into their sort of key positions now, where they've spent the last couple of seasons sort of battling to get to where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, overall, I was happy with the finale. The big set piece in particular was spectacular.
Beautiful.
And I feel that Cersei was, I feel she was the MVP of that whole episode.
Oh yeah.
It's sort of like, with Cersei, she's become, I think really since day one, she's been the most interesting character, and I wish that she was given more recognition. I think the fact that she's always stood out, people mm-hmm. were always very quick to overlook her character, and within that episode, it was sort of like, you know, you can knock me down, but I'm going to come back and knock you back twice as hard.
Right.
Because it seemed that they've basically beaten her down over the course of the previous seasons, but you know that by the end of this season, she was standing proud. She was like, if there's an alpha female in Game of Thrones, then Cersei is her name.
Right.
That's the feeling I got. And obviously, we've got the Mother of Dragons finally coming into the game. The guys over in the island whose team I can never remember.
Oh, the Greyjoys, the Iron Islands, the Ironborn.
Yeah, the Iron Islands.
The Ironborn. The Theon and Yara Greyjoy.
Yeah, they've also finally decided to join us.
Yeah.
Because so, again, with their storyline, it felt like they're introduced, okay, we've got their uncle who's going to go off and wants to kill them. They're heading off with all these ships. And then we have nothing for them for about four episodes. And then it felt like the finale, it's like, oh yeah, they're still here.
I guess that's actually a little bit better than what happened to Ilaria Sand and the Sand Snakes in Dorne, where it was like, and I think it was in the first or second episode, it's like they start off by killing Dorne, and it's like, and now we're not going to do anything for the rest of the season. You know?
Yeah.
And basically, they're that wonderful, wonderful scene. Any scene with Diana Rigg, who really is, I think, one of the best weapons in the GOT arsenal. Her performance is Olenna Tyrell. But I thought that was just, you know, that was part of that was just to remember and say, and let's remember that Indira Varma is out there somewhere.
I mean, the only other sort of scene I really particularly enjoyed was the sort of final scenes with the Kingslayer. And the fact that he's there being the ladies' man, and he's with, is it, with the imp's former protector. And he's basically like, oh, these women are interesting. It's like, no, I think they rather feel your golden fingers tickling their fanny.
Oh, yeah. When he and Bronn are dining with the Freys. Yeah.
I mean, I have to apologize again, the fact that I can remember these characters.
There's roughly 200 of them, you know?
There's so many! This is the thing, I tend to learn who they are, and then they tend to get killed off.
Yeah. That's
why I never back anyone in this race anymore, because as soon as I get attached to anyone, they're just doomed.
Yeah.
But as we said, that's what keeps George R. R. Martin alive.
Yeah.
The sustenance of fanboy tears.
Yep.
But yeah, has anything else been holding your interest at all, is it?
It's been kind of a short cycle since the last episode we recorded. So the only real thing that I've really done TV-wise, is I have started and I've watched the first, I think, three or four episodes of Mr. Robot.
Okay, how are you finding it?
I'm enjoying it. It's got a very, very interesting vibe to it.
Yeah.
It's definitely kind of like a conspiracy show, and yet it's not like any of the conspiracy shows that I'm used to. It's very weird, and the character of I can't remember his name, but the lead. But anyway, like the lead character, and that actor puts in an amazing.
Oh, sorry.
Performance.
Yeah, Elliot.
Elliot. Yeah, the actor putting in an amazing performance. You're not entirely sure how much there he is. He's definitely got some emotional problems. He's definitely got, I think there's certainly like kind of a distraction to him. The scenes with him and his psychiatrist, the Gloria Rubin character in the first episode, I thought were absolutely brilliant, with both of the actors and both the characters really kind of nailing that sort of relationship, where Elliot is the sort of person who, I think he realizes that he's got kind of like issues, he's got troubles, he's troubled or whatever you want to call it, you know, what do you want to call his relationship with his mental illness. But on the other hand, he kind of really holds in contempt any attempt to really try to, you know, really analyze him or really try to kind of get to the bottom of it. I think it's a great cast. Christian Slater. I don't think I've ever enjoyed Christian Slater this much in anything.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, this is, it was like this show, it's like that character was written for him. He's just amazing on this show.
Yeah, I mean, Christian Slater, he's one of those actors, I mean, I've enjoyed, but again, I've not watched a huge amount of what he's done. I've sort of seen him more as he sort of popped up with the way he sort of, like, come into my movie watching world is just if he happened to be in something that I've had an interest in, such as Heathers.
Right.
Or Broken Arrow, or Hard Rain. It's sort of like he just sort of slipped in there.
He's had a career kind of like Winona Ryder's, where he was kind of like a hot item when he was very young, with and again the Winona Ryder connection, you know, they were in Heathers together, and you know, there was kind of a point where we really, I'm not 100% sure where it was with Christian Slater. For Winona Ryder, I really think it was kind of like the very polarized responses people had to the Coppola Dracula. And there was kind of like a point where we really stopped taking, it seemed we really stopped taking those two actors seriously for a very long time, until they really started to kind of become more character actors.
Yeah. I think with Christian Slater, I mean, he obviously had the drugs and alcohol problems.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at his filmography, and I would say really around sort of 98, it starts to go downhill. He starts to take on a number of blundering sort of roles when you look at him doing things such as like Wind Talkers, 3,000 Miles to Graceland, Churchill, The Hollywood Years.
Yeah.
And then he sort of enters into that DTV sort of period where he's doing things such as Alone in the Dark. Or Hollow Man 2. And indeed, within those sort of periods, there are still some really interesting roles, such as Dolan's Cadillac, which...
Oh, he's in Dolan's Cadillac?
Yeah, he plays Dolan.
Wow.
The main guy.
Not the actor. I've never seen it. I've read the original short novel by Stephen King. He is not who I had in mind for Dolan.
Now, he's absolutely fantastic. I mean, if anyone who's read Dolan's Cadillac, it's basically a short story about revenge. And that's what the film is. It's about this guy who, him and his wife, they witness this people shipping operation that's gone wrong. And they get caught up with this gangster known as Jimmy Dolan. And this guy's wife, he gets killed, and he basically sets him on this path of revenge against Dolan. But the problem is Dolan travels everywhere in this bulletproof Cadillac of the title. So the way, I'm not going to obviously ruin it, but the way it all comes together, and it looks basically like your main character is going for this sort of like breakdown and stuff, but he's actually very carefully gaining all the skills he needs to pull off this perfect revenge. And it's absolutely chilling, the finale of that. But if you enjoyed the short story, I highly recommend checking it out. And because it was a DTV movie, a lot of people think sort of overlooked it, especially because it's, you know, a Stephen King DTV movie.
Right.
And we all know there's plenty of those, and they're not particularly good.
Right.
And, you know, it's Christian Slater. You know, he's at this point still seems perceived as a fallen star. He hadn't done Mr. Robot. I mean, Mr. Robot's basically, for him, what Kevin Bacon found with The Following.
Right.
Or Kiefer Sutherland found with 24. It's that revival role.
Right.
And it's unsurprising when you watch it that he obviously got, he won a Golden Globe Award for that role.
Right.
I mean, I'm a little further ahead of you. I think I'm around episode 10, so I'm coming to the end of the first season. And there are parts of it where you're kind of confused what's going on, but at the same time, it slowly comes, it does all sort of come together, all the pieces. The main problem, as I've said to you before, though, is I keep getting distracted by all the landmarks and the warriors. The fact they have a meeting on the Wonder Wheel, it was just too much.
Uh-huh.
That was just completely fanboyed out over that moment, that's for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, is it something you're gonna stick with, or?
Yeah, that one, I had to put it aside. I ended up getting distracted by Stranger Things, so I ended up putting it aside, and then I had to put it aside to kind of catch up with what I needed to catch up with for this.
Yeah.
I'm going to get back to it, basically, once we're done recording this, and once we, I kind of have, like, an idea of what I'm going to be, need to be watching the next few weeks, and looking at my free time and all that.
Yeah.
You will also be pleased to know that I have lined the first season of Veep up for myself. I haven't watched it yet, but it's I have lined it up.
For myself, it's probably one of the funniest shows on there. I know whenever we get it over here, we have the option on Sky to watch it as a complete box set before they show it all. And
oh, good. Nice.
Not but this season, but the previous season, I think I watched the whole season in like 2 days.
Yeah.
It's like one episode after the next. It's just really, really good. And it's only got better as it's gone on. And even though the final season could have ended it, it sort of had an end note to it.
Uh-huh.
I'm still very excited the fact that they're doing another season. So I'm very excited to see where it goes. So
cool.
I'm interested to see what you make of it, because obviously it's based on an English series and
right.
Americanized. So
actually, I don't think I've seen the thick of it either.
Okay.
That's something I've been, again, that's kind of been on my list, short, like, kind of vague list of things that I'm interested in that I have just simply not gotten around to yet. Cool. What about you?
It's really been a case of just finishing up series at the moment. As of the last season, I said I had one more episode of Banshee to watch, and that's now been finished. So
mm-hmm.
Banshee is sadly done and dusted. The final season, it was very hit and miss. It didn't seem to know where it was going and kind of pulled it back with its final episode, which in many ways it wrapped up a lot of what's been happening over the course of the series and still had that sort of open-endedness where you've got the feeling that if Alan Ball wanted to, he could come back and maybe do like a mini-series. He could do something with it again. And part of me kind of wishes that they're going to. Mainly because it still feels that there's still stories to be told, even
right.
though we had a lot of conclusion with the final episode. But we did have the fantastic line, wow, the butler actually did do it. Yeah, Banshee, it's not, I think we had four seasons, and it's been kind of pulpy, but it's kind of been nice to have a pulpy sort of crime show in that respect, especially when everything else is so heavy and complex.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong. There's absolutely nothing wrong with pulpiness if it's done right.
Yeah.
You know, it can be very... Pulpiness can be done very, very well, very entertainingly.
Exactly. And, I mean, this contained all Alan Ball's usual favourite themes, so violence, sex, and nudity. And it was a show that just, like, constantly managed to introduce interesting villains, had great sort of storylines that felt very much like they were one-off stories, but at the same time you knew they were forming a bigger picture for the season. But yeah, it's a show that's been sort of packed with stand-up moments, and I hope that now it's finished, and especially with the box that's being pushed over here especially, I'm hoping that more people can obviously check it out. And if, you know, with so many shows they're wrapping up now sort of the time to really sort of go back and catch up on some of the shows that you've missed. But as I said, it's really not been a particularly busy sort of cycle for TV watching. Is basically I watched the end of Game of Thrones, watched the end of Banshee, coming to the end of Billions, and as we talked about on the last show, that's happening.
Uh-huh.
I've got no real major comments to say on Billions still. I'm still enjoying it. Unreal I actually will talk a little bit about. As the last episode we had, obviously over in the States, we've had a number of police shootings.
Right.
And not to get too political in it, there was a recent shooting where a black man was shot going for his driver's license.
One recent shooting? Yeah, I know the one you're talking about, though, yeah.
That one in particular was the one that came to mind. There's a scene in Unreal that was scarily close to this.
Yes.
Now, as far as I'm aware, they filmed Unreal before this event happened. So this is another of those scary events like the pilot episode of The Lone Gunman, where you had the plane going for the two Twin Towers.
Right.
Where life is imitating art. So we were watching this episode of Unreal. My wife turned to me and goes, "Oh, that's a bit soon." I was like, you know they filmed this before that actually happened. So, but no, Unreal is still a great season.
There's a very interesting interview with the writer of that episode at the AV Club.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I have not been watching Unreal. I've heard a lot of good things about it, but it's not. The subject matter is generally not something that grabs me immediately. I may or may not pick it up at some point, but there's other things I have ahead of it. But there was a bit because as I alluded to, there's a specific shooting that you're referencing, but over the past month, over here in the States, there has literally been like one of these shootings, incidents happening sometimes twice a week that are getting reported like this of unarmed, or if not unarmed, then basically non-threatening black males being shot by police.
Yeah.
The episode in particular has inspired a lot of kind of like think pieces about how to handle this kind of subject in kind of like the age of Black Lives Matter. I know that the AV, I didn't read the whole, I read the interview. They did a for your consideration think piece comparing it to a couple of other, I don't remember what, I think one of the other shows might have been The Good Wife. Comparing it to like similar incidents on recent plots and other shows. That one I kind of skimmed, but the interview itself with the writer of that episode, who is a woman of color, very interesting.
Yeah, I mean, this season has obviously been playing the race card quite heavily, with obviously the focus on being the fact that they have the first black suitor.
Right.
So there's been, obviously, they've have played it in places. They've obviously had a character from the South who turns up wearing like the Confederate flag bikini and stuff.
Oh, so they've been trying to
play this, and they arrange the date so she can go down, so they can basically send him down to the South.
Wow. In
a fun twist, her parents and family are like super welcoming, and they're all like pro football fans.
Mm-hmm.
So that he's there like shooting guns and stuff. So it kind of blows up in the face this big hope to like have this big racist moment happen on TV.
Yeah. Because
the key sort of thread with Unreal is the fact that they're constantly trying to manipulate events to try and improve the ratings.
Right.
So morals don't come into it.
If they
can find something to exploit in a contestant, they will.
Right.
And it's just basically seeing how far they're willing to sink in pursuit of ratings. And that's where the joy of the show goes, and the fact that it constantly seems to manage to burn and cremate characters and still keep going.
Yeah.
That's the joy of it, just the fact that it's just such car crash television, but it's just so gripping to watch, even though it's probably not the deepest of shows you can watch out there. But no, definitely worth checking out if you've got Amazon Prime. It's on there, available to stream the first two seasons now, so.
Okay.
But other than that, the other shows I've watched are both True Life shows. We've just recently started a show called Eden over here on Channel 4.
Okay.
Where basically they've took a bunch of people with the idea of rebooting society. So they're in this piece of Scottish moorland, and they've been given some basic resources. And they've all come with different skills, like there's a carpenter and a a vet and a doctor and a sheep herder and a scavenger. So they've all got these different skills, and they're basically being required to rebuild their society, and they're there for a year. So they have no contact with the outside world. They're filming everything themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically, we've had the first episode now, and already you're seeing some division as personalities have started to come, and as people who have certain skills are realizing sort of the issues of where they're currently located, which is obviously by the coast. And he's like one of the explorer guys. They basically said, well, we're on the coast, when we come to winter, we're going to have 90-mile-per-hour winds. We need to build inland. But of course, they're too busy dicking around and having a good time and making homebrew and that. And he's basically gone off to the woods to go and build his little structure because he's like, you know what? Don't listen to me. Fuck you all. So it's going to be interesting to see how it plays out. The other one, obviously, being Alone, which is, I believe, on the History Channel. And basically, they put the survival sort of enthusiasts out in the middle of, I think it's Pennsylvania they are. They're basically in this black bear heavily populated area.
Uh-huh.
And they were allowed to use like 10 items to take with them. And
right.
Each location they have seems to have its own different sort of pros and cons. The ex-military dry they dropped off in the first, amongst the first group, lasted about 6 hours.
Uh-huh.
But I have to say, it seems like they dropped in the middle of a black bear population, because everywhere it's just like bear shit everywhere.
Yeah.
And it was just this guy like freaking out for like the whole time he's there, that there's like a bear in the woods.
Wow.
Like coming to get him. But yeah, that's another, for some reason I've just been really interested in watching people try and survive out in the wilderness. So that's where my interests have kind of lied recently. So, but apart from that, it's just been a lot of rewatching, lots of finishing up series. So.
Uh-huh.
No, maybe by the next episode I'll watch something new for you guys. But at the moment, most of my shows you can find out more by listening to our previous episodes. So, but should we move on to the first of our shows this evening then, Lucky?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's all recording still, so that's fine.
All right, I'm back.
Yeah, that's cool.
Okay.
That's fine. Okay, so we'll start with me, Six and Destroy. So yeah, Lucky, I mean, do you want to introduce the first of tonight's episodes then?
Can do! First show that we're going to discuss tonight, the first episode is the fourth episode of the first season of Rick and Morty. It's called Me Seeks and Destroy. Rick and Morty is a show. It's an animated show. I believe it runs on Adult Swim, the Adult Swim program from Cartoon Network.
Yep.
And it is very recently out of nowhere, become one of the bigger talking, one of the bigger shows, the animated shows to be talked about. Created by somebody who has been something of an unknown quantity before now, a chap by the name of Justin Roiland, and executive produced by the somewhat legendary Dan Harmon, of course, of Community fame. Rick and Morty started life as a kind of a mean-spirited parody of Back to the Future after Roiland, who was a staffer on Bill Cosby sitcom, apparently ran into some problems with some Back to the Future references that he wanted to make on the show. So as a result of this, he did a, from what I heard, a kind of a mean-spirited, dirty parody of Back to the Future called Doc and Marty, both names misspelled. And those characters eventually, while that particular thing is not considered part of the Rick and Morty canon. Those characters were the genesis of the main characters for Rick and Morty. Rick Sanchez is an older, hedonistic, selfish, alcoholic, mad scientist who basically out of nowhere shows back up in his daughter's life after a long absence with his and moves in with his daughter, his son-in-law, and two kids, daughter Summer and son Morty, and starts and kind of strikes up this really kind of weird relationship with everybody, but particularly Morty. They have this sort of almost, I don't know how to describe the relationship. They're affectionate, and you get the feeling that Rick genuinely loves his family, but it's also more than a little abusive. And that's where we pick up, like I said, Rick is a mad scientist. He invents all sorts of weird contraptions and has all sorts of weird, and he's been taking, he has this car that can fly through space and he can travel to other dimensions. There's a multiverse out there, which becomes more and gradually more and more important as the first season goes on. By this point in the season, I don't think it had been quite as important up to this point. I don't remember whether this takes this. I think this is the episode before Rick Potion number 9,
yeah,
which is the one that really kind of shows you, that really kind of opens up and really opens up the possibilities for this show. But to kind of like shrink this down to something we can actually talk about for a single episode, Rick has a portal gun, not even remotely unlike the one from the video game. And they decide to, Rick, the episode opening opens with Morty complaining that he never gets to kind of lead the adventures that they go on. So he had sets up this bet with Rick. They're going to go on in some sort of adventure. And this is interrupted as a mad scientist. His daughter, Rick's daughter, and the rest of the family are always asking him to basically handle stupid stuff for him. And out of kind of exasperation with them always asking to help with, you know, fix things or help them with their help them with homework, he gives them what he calls a Meeseeks box. And a Meeseeks box is, it's a box that kind of resembles the Portal Companion Cube and has a button on it, a blue button on it. You press the blue button and a Mr. Meeseeks appears. Mr. Meeseeks announces himself by introducing himself as Mr. Meeseeks and imploring you to look at him. A Meeseeks basically lives, you give a task to a Meeseeks, they complete it, and they wink out of existence. So Rick's daughter and son-in-law and granddaughter basically decide to, you know, each summon a Meeseeks apiece to help them with their problems. One of the other kind of weird relationship things that goes that kind of leads throughout the series is the relationship between Beth and her husband Jerry, who is played by Chris Parnell from SNL. And if you're an Archer fan, he sounds almost disconcertingly like Cyril Figgis. But they have a relationship that is a marriage that is, shall we say, very rocky. She is feeling she wants the Meeseeks to try to help her work out why she feels unfulfilled in her marriage. Summer wants to become popular at school, and Jerry wants to take two strokes off of his golf game. And the central joke for this plot is that the Meeseeks that Beth and Summer summon help them solve their problems comparatively easily and wink out of existence almost immediately, while the task of helping Jerry take two strokes off his golf game becomes so frustrating for the Meeseeks that Meeseeks summons another Meeseeks to help him, to the point where you've got about 20 or 30 Meeseeks all arguing this point. The B plot, then also follow Rick and Morty on their B plot, where they go to some sort of fantasy land where Morty wants to go on a quest to help a village, a poor village from the, escape from the giant that has been oppressing them. And it goes into a number of places you would not expect a story like this to go, including a courtroom and some really, really dark areas. My opening remarks on Rick and Morty as a show and what it is about this show that makes it so special is that they're really, I've never seen anything like it anywhere. I don't even know if there's really anything else in the Adult Swim canon that is really is almost as hard to kind of put your finger on than this. This is a show that has so many things in it that it's almost hard to describe. It's definitely, you can definitely see, particularly in the physical design of Rick as a character, you can definitely see where they're coming, where people who make the initial Doc Brown and Marty references are coming from. But this is almost this sort of weird combination of like Fringe and Doctor Who and other stuff and toilet humor. And in this one episode, it goes from being scatological to philosophical to emotional drama to exceptionally dark. There is a scene that basically involves child molestation. And it's almost, it's got a little bit of stuff here and there, but I don't even know that South Park, I think, kind of often kind of juggles these different elements and tones. But it does so very, very well, and in a way that it is honestly one of the most thought-provoking science fiction shows I've seen in a long time. And just, you know, the fact that it contains fart jokes and a character, you know, later on in the series named Mr. Poopy Butthole, really kind of just only adds to the sort of surrealness of the show. So what do you think about the show and this episode in particular?
Yeah, I mean, this show in particular, I think, first of all, we have to also give thanks to Mr. Robert Zerbe of To the Escape Hatch. For some reason, Robert Zerbe has formed this cult-like following of getting people hooked on this show. I believe it was one of the first shows that me and you recorded together, Lucky.
And I still feel bad that I wanted to get to the show, two of the shows that were recommended. One of them, obviously, being Rick and Morty. The other one was the one you recommended, which was that Tim in the Book of Pure Evil? Have I got the name right?
It was Todd in the Book of Pure Evil, which Robert also accused me of making up.
that one disappeared from Netflix about 2 weeks after the recording of the episode. I literally had it in the queue, in my Netflix queue, and then it disappeared.
Okay. For some reason, Robert Zerbe is just obsessed with this show. And at the time of us recording it, no one had heard of Rick and Morty. Now, since that episode, it's slowly, like, formed, gone out, like Hydra's tentacles to envelop most of the lamb, where it started off with about four people being hooked in the show. And then they told two people. And then they told two people. And now, if you ask people who told you about the show, you can pretty much link it all back to him. So
yeah.
I'm just going to say, if you're offended by anything you hear on today's show, please go to theescapehatch.com and voice your concerns with Mr. Zerbe, because it's his fault. Although
yes.
I think that Dan Harmon and co. should really cut him a check, because he's probably done the best promotion for the show out of anyone I know.
Yeah.
I'm just going to warn in advance that this episode, both for this show and the Outer Limits show we're going to be talking about later, we are going to be going into spoilers, so spoiler warning in advance. This episode, as you said, it goes in so many different directions, and there are a number of dark moments, especially for this show, which is really saying something. But yeah, we obviously have Rick and Morty, our two sort of heroes as such. Rick, obviously, being this idea of what happens if you give someone with ultimate knowledge just the, like, zero morals whatsoever. So basically he exploits his knowledge for his own personal gain. As you said, at the same time, he has this weird relationship with not only Morty, but Summer as well, where he still plays the loving grandfather, but it's normally when their relationship is put at risk that he decides to actually show that he cares.
Right.
A lot of the time he's basically has this care for existence that things are going to work themselves out, and he basically cares more about getting wasted or doing his own thing than actually helping them out until it obviously a situation presents itself. There's another episode where he reunites with his ex-girlfriend who has this ability to control all beings around her, and she's basically taken over this planet. So he's like looks over this city where he thinks they are, and sees these nukes fall down. He's like, you know my grandchildren are in there? It's like, no, they weren't. I moved everyone to this city over here. And it's...
Yay! Hi, Rick. Everybody's okay.
You kind of like... It's so touching when he does have these moments, but they're so few and far between. And I don't know, have you seen the final end of season two yet?
I binged. When it finally came to Hulu, and I've been waiting for this damn thing to come to Hulu for a year now.
Yeah.
I binged it all in about 2 days, so I am up to speed on Rick and Morty.
Yeah, and I think it's really in the final episode you find out that, you know, he does actually care about these people.
Uh-huh.
In fact, he's willing to essentially just turn himself in. And it's during the final episode we actually find out just what he's done.
Right.
Because we see him do a lot of really nasty and morally devoid things on the show. This episode in particular is kind of interesting, the fact that a lot of the moral complexities fall on Morty rather than Rick.
Yeah.
If anyone's going to do anything wrong, it's Morty in this episode.
Right.
They're going through his list of charges, and he's like, what are you in for? And he's like, everything. And you think you've seen... You just kind of wonder what else he could have done that you haven't seen already on the course of the show.
Right.
Just obviously break it down into its two, obviously, plot points. Just going to focus on Rick and Morty's sort of plot line for the minute, because, as you said, they're in this fantasy land, and they get caught up in this Jack and the Beanstalk-style plot where it goes very dark very quick. So they go to the giant's palace to steal his gold. But the giant comes in, and trips over and kills himself by hitting his head on the table, which then the giant's wife turns up, and it sort of like accuses Rick and Morty of manslaughter, or giant slaughter, I guess. So they're put on trial, and it's like, wow, that got dark really, really quick. And this is even before we get into the bar scene, where they're basically going down from the courtroom steps, but because it's in a giant world, they're basically having to rock climb down all these steps. So they find a bar, like, partway down the steps called the Thirsty Step. And you think that the episode's got dark, and then it gets even darker still as we get to meet the really delightful character known as Mr. Jellybean.
Yep.
And, I mean, Mr. Jellybean, what can Mr. Jellybean do? He's, you know, this delightful, friendly guy. No, he's a bloody rapist.
Mr. Jellybean tries to rape Morty in the bathroom. Trigger warning.
My
God. You know,
God.
And it's. I remember when I first watched this episode, I was sitting here thinking to myself, I am hallucinating this plot. I am not watching this. This is not the other plot in this episode. I am somehow confabulating this in my brain. Because yeah. There is no fucking way, there is no fucking way anybody would be able to do a plot line, even on an animated show, even on cable, even on Adult Frigging Swim. You know, I thought, you know, that Adult Swim was, you know, taking some risks and pushing the envelope with an episode a long time ago of, Aqua Teen called Hand Banana.
Okay.
You know, where they basically somehow genetically engineer like this hand shaped dog that basically goes around threatening to rape a specific character. You know, and this dog says things like, "All I know are ball, and the only words I know are ball and good." Grape. And it's like, it's one of those things where it's like, this is funny, but I don't know if there is something deeply inside me that is sick for finding it funny. You know, it's one of those things that it's just the absurdity alone. You know, Morty is threatened with rape by Mr. Jellybean. It reminds me of an old George Carlin not a one-liner, but just a brief George Carlin bit where he was talking about rape, and he says, some people say you can't make jokes about rape. They say rape's not funny. I think rape is hilarious. Imagine Porky Pig raping Elmer Fudd. Which is a hilarious idea once you've got that in your head. You know, you can imagine, you know, Porky Pig stammering his way through a threat, you know, or Elmer Fudd crying. It's not something that really, like, the rape itself is not funny, but just the absurdity of the characters in that particular situation, and that you would never, ever in your life think would be in a situation like that if a comedian hadn't just basically put that image in your head. And that is something that this show does very, very well. It can do that shock value, but it has the shock value just isn't there for shock value. There's some substance to it.
Yeah.
And this is one of the ones, and when I picked this episode, all I remembered really was the Meeseeks plot. I had forgotten this was the adventure plot as well. So when they start talking about the bed at the beginning, it's holy shit. I am going to get into some, this episode is going to get me and Elwood into some deep shit. Because yeah. We're talking about, I mean, Morty is like, what, 12? Morty is supposed to be 12 or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, he's a high school student.
Yeah. And it's just, I don't know where else you're going to see stuff like this, for good or for ill. I don't know if there's anything out there quite like this. It is utterly unique as far as I can tell.
I was racking my brains as you were obviously saying that, and certainly in terms of bad taste, it's still below like South Park.
Right.
South Park is still untouchable within those sort of full stakes, but the fact is South Park's kind of earned its way to that sort of level because of the amount of seasons it's had, and it's built it over time and through reputation that people know what South Park is going to be. This
right.
is what they revel in. Rick and Morty, we're here. This is first season Rick and Morty, as we said. I mean, we're 5 episodes in to this show. The only sort of credibility it has, not to take anything away from anyone who works on it, is the fact that Dan Harmon is executive producer and he did Community. Well, he did Community, got fired from Community, and then went back to Community because, you know, he pissed off Chevy Chase, which is always a great move for your career.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the show, even before this episode, had gone dark. I think even back in episode 1, where we've got the family dog that takes over the world.
The second episode, yeah, the lawnmower dog.
Or we've got the Christmas episode where they're talking about the Pirates of the Pancreas ride.
Rick warns them
that the pirates are kind of rapey.
Yeah, the Anatomy Park, the Jurassic Park parody.
Yeah. So there's been hints, but here it doesn't hold back. It goes fully for it. And obviously Morty beats Mr. Jellybean up. I mean, he fully batters him, and he comes out of the bathroom and he's fully sort of shaken, and it was a realistic portrayal of someone who's been through that. And you know, at the back of your mind, you've got to remember this is a comedy show, so you know, this is what we're going to go for big laughs with. And Rick obviously sees what's happened, but he doesn't ever make a thing of it. He doesn't acknowledge what's happened because Morty doesn't want to obviously talk about it,
right.
And Rick obviously cleans it up, so to speak. But he doesn't belittle Morty. And I mean, the whole thing with their subplot is that Morty's got to get to decide the adventure. But if it sucks, then Rick's the only one who gets to decide the adventure. And, you know, Rick could at this point could have easily said, you know what, you failed. I get to choose all the adventure now. But he doesn't. He goes, I've got all these winnings from karaoke. You know, well, let's take the slug ride down the steps and stuff.
Yeah.
And he shows some like real compassion for his grandson.
This is, I think, the point at which it's like I would have to go and revisit the plot progression. But I think this is the point where they really start to humanize Rick, because for the most part, Rick is fairly one-dimensional up to this point in the show. You know, as are most of the characters, to be honest. You know, this is a character, this is a show that somewhat plays a long game when it comes to character development. Yes. So that you think you have a handle on how shallow you think these characters are. And then you really start to get, again, for an animated series, this is extraordinarily sophisticated storytelling. And this is, again, you know, I keep going back to this. This is not something that you wouldn't, you know, you've got to keep in mind the context here that you're talking about, you know, a plot line that involves them going to basically a fantasy land, you know, and walking into a fairy tale and then walking from the fairy tale, remaining in the fairy tale land, but essentially walking into like a Law and Order type plot.
Yeah.
Which, you know, comes up with my favorite line of the entire episode. The fee, fi, fo, fum, I smell a civil liberties violation. And then goes to this sort of weird kind of abstract, sort of almost like Phantom Tollbooth type thing with talking staircase goblins and, you know, a talking snail and an anthropomorphic jelly bean. And then that goes from there to this incredibly realistic scene where the jelly bean does this.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you know, when you're at the end of that scene, you're sitting here thinking to yourself, how is Morty ever going to explain this in therapy? You know, because this is definitely something that, you know, fucks him up inside.
Yeah, I love the fact, though, that you find out that Mr. Jellybean isn't just also an attempted rapist. He's also the king of this kingdom.
The post-credit stinger is really kind of like the icing on the cake here, where the villagers find the stash of child porn that Mr. Jellybean had amassed, or King Jellybean had amassed, and decided that they needed to basically destroy it in order to preserve... you know, in order to preserve the legacy of King Jellybean.
When they get returned to this village, they're supposedly helping, though, and it's like, oh, you must meet the king, and they wheel out Mr. Jellybean on the sedan chair. Oh, I just laugh so hard because he's just battered.
I mean, Morty just beat the shit out of him and tried to flush him down the toilet, and he looks like one battered jelly bean.
Yeah. But, it's certainly a dark subject to handle. I mean, when I watch Rick and Morty, the only shows that I can really compare it to would be Invader Zim or the cartoon series of The Tick.
Uh-huh.
They're the only shows I can think of which obviously worked with pop culture and fancy elements the way that this show does, but right. They certainly didn't go this dark. Rick and Morty sort of lies in that middle no man's land between those shows and South Park.
Right.
It's not quite rude and filthy enough to be South Park level. It's certainly not child friendly and sort of PC correct enough to be down with like Invader Zim and The Tick, which are obviously kind of like kids' cartoons that evolved out of that status and found themselves an adult audience.
Right.
I mean, obviously the other plot line we've got here, and to say it's the A plot, it just feels like so overshadowed by the B plot here.
Well, right, because of that one, but it's got in its own way, it's got its heavy elements as well.
Yeah, I mean, we've obviously got the Mr. Meeseeks, who they only have one tone, which is basically to shout everything. And I mean, this episode all came about because Dan Harmon started screaming, "I'm Mr. Meeseeks." That's all it. What it evolved from.
Uh-huh.
So how they sort of put it all together, but I love the fact that Jerry is a character who's so useless, and this is a theme that's like returned to frequently throughout the show, that no matter which dimension you're in, Jerry is always going to be useless.
Right.
To the point where there's actually a daycare center where you can put your Jerrys. And it seems, because as the series goes, and certainly in season two, we see like the other multiverse versions of Rick and Morty, to the point where we also have the Council of Ricks. And the fact that we got a Jerry daycare center in one of the episodes just really says a lot about how useless it is. And the fact that he can frustrate the Meeseeks to the point where they go on a murderous rampage to kill Jerry, because this is the only way they can see for them to disappear. Their whole purpose is to solve problems and then disappear. But the fact that they can't solve an issue has driven them insane.
You know, and the joke here, of course, as I said earlier, is that, you know, Summer and, damn it, I forgot her name again.
Beth.
Summer and Beth, in theory, have these problems that essentially basically work on their own self-esteem. You know, the lesson that Summer learns is that, you know, the way to become more popular is to, you know, in many ways, just kind of not care about popularity in a sort of paradoxical way. Beth learns that, you know, before anything else, you know, as much as she is Jerry's wife or Rick's daughter or Morty and Summer's mother, she is herself an individual person with individual needs, and she needs to take care of herself and she needs to like herself. Jerry, you know, and those two problems get solved very easily. Jerry only wants to take two strokes off his golf game, you know. And all of the problem is with this, and this is, of course, as somebody who's actually tried to learn how to golf and has not really gotten the knack for it, you know, it's like, you know, the Meeseeks is constantly throwing these catchphrases like, you got to square your shoulders, or you got to choke, you got to work the follow through. And it's like, what does any of this even mean? And it's just he is so useless at it that it just becomes one Meeseek summoned another Meeseeks and summons another Meeseeks. And there's this sort of like existential, you know, the Meeseeks are inborn with this kind of existentialism built into them. You know, one of the Meeseeks says towards the end where they decide that basically the only way they can take two strokes off of Jerry's golf game is to take all strokes off his golf game by killing him. And basically they track him down to like to a restaurant where he's trying to basically put the fire back in his marriage with Beth. You know, and they trap him, he gets locked in a meat locker. You know, and they're basically the I think the prime Meeseeks is basically laying it out for him. He's basically saying, you know, and this kind of contrasts with a quote, and it's one of the big quotes later on in the series, you know, about three or four episodes down the line, where Morty says, you know, the line that Morty says down the line is, I'm going to go with this one first. Nothing means anything. Nobody is here for any reason. And we're all going to die. So just come and watch TV and don't worry about it. You know, and the counterpoint to this is the Meeseeks says, Meeseeks are not born into the world fumbling for purpose. We have one singular purpose we must fulfill. Our existence is pain. We all want to die. We all want to complete our tasks so we can die. And they literally just poof out of existence when they're done. The Meeseeks have been driven insane, literally, by the existential dread that they cannot fulfill their purpose that they are born into. And it's just amazing. And again, there's, like I said, a depth here that you would not necessarily, I know I sound must sound like a broken record, like you wouldn't necessarily expect this, but again, we're talking about a blue thing with a tuft of hair, and it's definitely a creature of fantasy.
Yeah.
It's definitely, I mean, it looks like Mr. Meeseeks looks like he was designed by a 5-year-old. You know, he's a blue creature with a big smiley face and a very thin body, and it's just, again, you're sitting here, and again, the constant thing I'm sitting here is like, am I watching a cartoon or am I hallucinating? I'm watching a cartoon and I'm actually in like a philosophy seminar discussing existentialism.
I was just about to say, I find that this world works very much on the same sort of logic and philosophy that Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy works on.
Right, right.
I mean, just for example, in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, in one of the books, they talk about the babelfish and how the babelfish can exist, because it's a fish that you put in your ear and it basically allows you to translate all language. And the explanation for it is that man has this discussion with God about God says I don't exist, and that God, basically man manages to disprove God, and God disappears in a puff of logic.
Right.
Said man then goes on to prove black is white and gets killed at the next zebra crossing.
Right. Yes. Yeah, the basic philosophy being that God says, I refuse to prove that I exist because I without faith, I'm nothing. You know, knowledge precludes faith. And man says, the babelfish, nothing like this could possibly evolve accidentally. Nothing this useful could just evolve. Therefore, it proves you exist. Therefore, you proved you exist. Therefore, you don't exist because knowledge precludes faith. You know, it's sort of you've hit the nail on the head there. And that's one of the things that I think Adams never really got, you know, enough credit for. You know, for actually kind of, you know, his kind of philosophical leanings. And you're very right. This is very much like The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. You know, Arthur Dent, Morty is a character who really is more somebody. He's more somebody that things happen to than an active character. He's someone who's not so much, you're constantly kind of throwing him, and Jerry is the same way, really. You keep seeing them in these positions where they are the sore thumbs. And yet, you know, Arthur says at one point, you know, just like Arthur Dent says at one point, I'm not different. I'm not so much different as I'm differing, you know? And that's the sort of, they're like the bastions of normality in this vast multiverse of chaos that, you know, somehow seems to make some sort of sense to Rick, but that the other characters never seem to entirely get a handle on. That Rick seems to be, if Rick may not necessarily have a handle on it, maybe he's just, you know, very good at bullshitting it, mm-hmm. but he accepts the chaos. He's comfortable with it in many ways because he is somewhat of an agent of chaos himself. And it just, you know, I think I've disappeared up my own butt by this point with my with being pretentious and arty and intellectual. But I mean, that's really just the thing here. This is a universe of chaos amongst a multiverse of chaos. We, in many ways, we are put as viewers in the same position as the characters, some of the characters in the show, where even we don't ever really have a grasp on what's going on. And there's really, you know, it's sometimes an episode will completely throw you for a loop, as the one that supplanted my favorite episode. Originally of the show was originally this one, and it's kind of been supplanted by a second season episode called Total Recall, which is the one with the memory parasite and Mr. Poopy Butthole, which is basically, basically you have this creature that basically worms its way into your brain and reproduces itself by putting false memories of itself in the form of someone that you have memories of all your life of knowing, but that is completely and utterly false. And, you know, this is an episode that introduces a character that you're supposed to, that all the, you know, it's like you have never seen this character before on the show, and yet everybody on the show acts as if he's known them all their lives, to the point where they even re-edited the intro sequence for that episode only to insert that character.
Yeah.
I mean, and to write, even remotely try to figure out how that happened, you know, it's like I said, it's got the vulgarity of South Park. It's got the depth of any sort of science fiction, you know, genuine science fiction you would ever want. It's got a sort of mystery and an ability to kind of draw you in an obsession that really kind of rivals True Detective. This is, I think, one of the best shows out there right now.
Yeah. I think we've certainly looked at it in this episode, I think, a lot deeper than I think it's ever been discussed before, probably. I would like, in my own sort of little fantasy world, that someone out there is listening to this show and they're taking down, it's like, taking all our little notes about, oh, the philosophy of Rick and Morty is the same mm-hmm. as Douglas Adams, and that they're going and they're using it to try and impress chicks and using it as a backup line for the Return of the Jedi contains one of the biggest war crimes speech from Clerks.
Yeah.
These are the two things they have in their back pocket so they can just like bust out at like frat parties or whatever just to seem like really deep and meaningful in some failed attempt to try and pick up the chicks.
Just remember, kids, if you ever write your post-grad thesis on the philosophy of Rick and Morty, the comparative philosophy of Rick and Morty, always remember to cite your sources, mainly Ian Elwood. And send a royalty payment to Robert Zerbe, because he deserves it.
Yes. As I said, we should start a campaign or something just to get Zerbe a check.
Yeah.
Even if it's like just like $10 or something. I think just the fact that he managed to throw out the show and it's become this obsession to anyone who's sort of like come in his radius of influence.
It's someone really, we should like set up like a GoFundMe to just get somebody to go to like Hollywood or wherever and just present a gigantic frigging check to Justin Roiland and Dan Harmon and have them write Robert into the show.
I think, just, you know, just like maybe a little special thanks or something.
Yep.
Maybe, you know, give him a cameo or something. There's, you know, man-eating burrito or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't know. But, yeah, if you definitely go show Robert some love over to thescapepatch.com. For some great film writing as well as highlighting his favorite film moments. And he has a number of great guest writers on there, including Jay Clewitt. And most recently, he had Jess from French Love Sunday doing a piece for him as well. So it's always worth checking his stuff out as well. But we were hoping to have him on the show, but unfortunately, schedules didn't work out. So
Robert's a great guy. He's a good pal of ours in the Lamb community. So go and give him some hits.
Anything else you want to discuss about
Rick? I think I've said everything I will ever want to say about Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything left to say.
I've got an urge to go and play Pocket Mortys now.
I tried to play Pocket Mortys for a while. I could never really get the hang of it. But then again, I never really played like the Pokemon games.
Yeah.
So I'm waiting for Pocket Mortys Go.
But to see Rick like stumble out of places like, you found Drunken Rick.
One of my absolute favorite like little bits of imagery that like kind of fan generated imagery, and I think I added it right to my Facebook wall right before logging on, was there's a sort of a little bit of, it was made to look like a screen from like the original Game Boy version of Pokemon, and it shows Rick and a Meeseeks with a Meeseeks box, and it says in a little pixelated font, "Wild Meeseeks appears." And then the other one that was really nice was the re-editing of an image from Watchmen, with Mr. Meeseeks in the position of Dr. Manhattan.
That's pretty genius as well.
Yeah.
And no, if you've not seen Rick and Morty, definitely check it out. Season 3 is coming soon. Anyone who listens to Dan Harmon's podcast, Harmontown, which is great, even if you're not a fan of the show, it's a really fun improv comedy podcast. And he drops hints of what's coming up. I think they're sort of finishing up the season now. It's actually going to be a longer season for season 3.
Right. There's going to be I knew there was going to be a longer delay on it. I don't think they've actually started the animation process. I think they're just finishing up the writing. And I did read somewhere that he has said by hook or by crook, he will force Mr. Meeseeks into the new season.
The only other sort of thing, sort of standout thing he sort of dropped is the fact that with the previous two seasons, they had an all male writing team. So with season three, they've actually brought on some women onto the team.
Very good.
I think we're going to start seeing some interesting angles with Beth and Summer. I know that that's only what he sort of hinted at on his sort of shows, because he's always kept it very under wraps, but he occasionally drops something out because he's normally drunk when he does Harmontown. So
yeah.
If you go to a Harmontown show, just try and lead it in that direction for Rick and Morty, see what you can get him to drop. So
yeah.
As I said, I think that's about it for Rick and Morty.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be looking at our second show this evening, as we look at an episode of The New Outer Limits with the episode The New Breed.
In a world where podcasts already seem to address every imaginable subject, one man broke new ground with a seemingly random obsession about exploding helicopters in movies. He was a podcaster on the edge, a maverick broadcaster who played by his own rules. Now, he has a last chance to talk about the strange way helicopters explode in film. Exploding Helicopter, available on iTunes and Podomatic now. Think you know about chopper fireballs? Think again.
Are you tired of the same daily troll? Well, get on over to Blitz and Chance! We got one game! We got a whole bunch of games here. We got Chabos and Flobos, and you can shoot things. Get over here, play the game. Use your Flurbos to get tickets. Roy, too, just got here. Get over here at Gypsy Chits.
It's the coolest place in the world. I get to be in the commercial.
And we're back. Obviously, in the first half of the episode, we went on a philosophical jaunt with Rick and Morty. Now, we're going to go for something a little lighter, as we're going to be looking at an episode of the reboot, of sorts, of The Outer Limits. This was the 15th episode of Season 1, shown way back in 1995. The episode is The New Breed, and in it we have this doctor called Dr. Stephen Ledbetter, who basically creates nanobots, with the idea of using them to clean up streams from toxic waste, and is working on trying to develop them so that he can cure disease and imperfections within the human body. At the same time, his sister's fiance, Andy, has found out that he is suffering from terminal cancer, and Andy basically sneaks in Steven's lab and injects himself with the nanobots, which in turn cure his cancer. Now, from the outset, Steven thinks, oh, this is great, you know, these nanobots, we can cure all diseases, you know, this is all perfect, but at the same time, we don't know what effect they have. We've never tested them on humans, let alone animals. So he starts conducting all these tests on Andy, and in turn, the nanobots decide that, you know, they need to upgrade Andy to match all these tests that he's having. And this episode is a real standout, especially for fans of body horror, as it takes on a real Cronenberg twist as the episode goes on, and as we will obviously cover when we go into the episode itself. But Lucky, I mean, you were saying you hadn't had much sort of experience with the new Outer Limits. Is that correct?
I'm a big fan of the old Outer Limits, as evidenced that by my pick for our very first episode was a second season episode of the original show. But I have not. No, I don't have a whole lot of experience with the Showtime, the reboot. I think of it as the Showtime show. Yeah. The series, but because that's why being a premium cable show is why you get all the additional kind of gore and obligatory nudity. This is very much in the spirit of the original show, particularly the first season of the original series, which was more the second season of the original Outer Limits was kind of more science fiction oriented, or more pure science fiction oriented. As evidenced by their adaptations of Harlan Ellison and I think Asimov stories. The first season, and the first season is the one with a lot of the iconic episodes, like Architects of Fear, which is one of the sources that Alan Moore rated for the plot lines in Watchmen. These are more in a kind of sci-fi horror vein. And there are particularly the one that I kept thinking of while watching The New Breed was an episode called The Sixth Finger, which is very, very similar kind of in its specifics, where an evolutionary scientist performs an experiment, a somewhat kind of like a Flowers for Algernon type experiment to increase the intelligence of a somewhat simple-minded Welsh miner, if I remember correctly, played by David McCallum. And by accelerating his evolution, and basically, you know, it's again, one of these kind of cautionary tales, and David McCallum ends up, you know, growing a sixth finger, thus the title, and, you know, the body horror elements, gets big cranium and goes bald and all that. And definitely you see the similarities there, the kind of... The tampering in God's domain. There's a wonderful scene right at the beginning of the episode of The New Breed, where Stephen Ledbetter is giving his presentation to, he's giving a presentation or a lecture or something to people at the university where he works, and somebody, you know, the token ethicist in the audience as to make a point of standing up and saying, "But aren't you playing God, Dr. Ledbetter?" And Ledbetter, played amazingly, I thought, by Richard Thomas, of who most people over the age of 40 or 50 in America, he will forever be John Boy Walton. And he also plays, he also until recently played Special Agent Frank Gadd on The Americans. Richard Thomas says, I don't think of myself as playing God. I'm just improving on him. You know, this very kind of pompous scientist voice. And that is very much the sort of classic sci-fi horror cautionary tale that The Old Outer Limits did very well. This is, I thought, just a wonderful kind of pulpy ride. It's definitely got its more thought-provoking points, but for the most part, it works on a more visceral, I felt, a more visceral than an intellectual level. Would you agree on that?
Oh, definitely. So, with this show, I mean, obviously, when it came out in 1995, this really sort of set a new benchmark for levels of sex and violence and nudity that were showing on television, really. There's certain episodes which really sort of raise that bar, and as I was discussing with you before we came on the show, back in 95, I mean, I didn't have my own TV. I used to have just the one family TV set that we'd all sit around and watch Outer Limits, my dad being a big sci-fi fan. So you'd be watching the show, and then you'd have like a sex scene or something come on, and you just feel really awkward that you're watching this with like your mom or something.
Yeah. And that was something I seem to remember. Like I said, over here, it was on a premium cable station. So where you would have seen it as kind of like, this is kind of like upping the game for what you can show on TV. Over here, it was like, that was stuff that they had to throw in to justify it being on a cable station. And I remember being surprised by that. One of the few episodes I have seen is the pilot episode. If I remember correctly, the one about the guy who builds the robot and then falls in love with her, or she falls in love with him or something like that. You know, like the sex and the nudity and the violent content and the gore.
Yeah. And I think it was really, when the show came out, it was very well timed, really. Especially over in the UK, where the BBC used it as a filler between seasons of The X-Files. So we'd have a season of The X-Files, and when that finished, they would show a season of The New Outer Limits. And mm-hmm. they knew that by doing so, they would keep their target audience, the X-Files, and essentially give them the same. And this show, I mean, back in 95, we have to remember there's no on-demand TV. There's few channels, especially for myself, we had four channels. You know, it's probably shock and awe for some of our younger listeners who probably can't cope unless they got at least 23 channels, but we only have four.
I do have to ask you, though, are you old enough to remember a time in Britain where there were only three channels?
I believe I was alive. I don't remember that sort of time as such. I remember everyone getting very excited when Channel 5 got added. But down in Cornwall, unless you had like a Freeview box, you couldn't actually get it.
Right.
So It was, yeah, I mean, that was back when people used to watch the BBC out of choice, back
yeah.
in 95. And I remember the show, it was sort of like, this was kind of my life downfall, really, because my mother knew that the best way to affect me and my brother would say, if we were like misbehaving, would say, right, you're not watching the Outer Limits, and that'd be like the worst thing, because you know you go to school the next day, all everyone wants to talk about is the Outer Limits and what they saw. And especially with a show like this, which is, I should say, it's very visual, it's very visceral. I mean, it's full of gore and violence, and everyone wants to talk about the nudity or the gory monster or whatever they saw that day. So it would be completely spoiled before you got a chance to go home and watch your recording. So I think me and my brother were probably better well-behaved in the lead-up to the new Outer Limits episodes than we were any other time of the week.
Right.
So, like, Outer Limits on, it's like back to being chaotic and naughty in that, so. But... yeah, this episode I remember when it first came out, and the opening credits, it kind of tweaks that classic Outer Limits episode where you have, you know, there's nothing wrong with your TV set, we control the picture. And the part in the credit scene where we have the shot of the house and you see the roots growing down and the music hits that really string orchestral part,
mm-hmm.
Where it goes like super creepy and it like really tenses you up. I remember using that little sample of music in like so many student projects and stuff when I was like doing my little horror movie pitches for like my version of Friday the 13th. It's all like, if I need a creepy piece of music, that would be the sample I used.
Yeah, it is kind of like there is a sort of spookiness to, and I felt that they updated that for the new show very well. That it's supposed to have kind of like... it's supposed to start off kind of innocuous, but gradually sort of increase in unease as they call it, the control voice.
Yeah.
Who narrates the intro and then also delivers the opening and ending narration. Really, I felt they did a very good job kind of replicating that sort of growing unease. The intro, of course, isn't as stark as the original. The original, really, the main thing about that is just the little oscilloscope, because back in the early 60s, if you wanted an easy, just shorthand image for science, it was either an oscilloscope or a reel-to-reel tape, or a big blank of bank of flashing lights, or if you were watching Doctor Who, all three, but go on.
But yeah, I mean, I think it was this combination of the control voice, the opening credit music, that it really set the tone for it. It sort of like drew you in, and you were set from just those simple little touches. You were set in the Outer Limits mindset that they needed you to be in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the opening narration for this one's fantastic. I mean, it goes, man has long worked to starve off the diseases that can ravage us. But what can happen when the cure grows more fearsome than the disease? These like little philosophical openings.
Uh-huh.
And as you watch it, it's sort of like, it comes back to you and you, but I love that they frame the episode. It's sort of like, you know, what does happen when your supposed cure becomes worse than the disease you originally tried to cure, in this case, cancer.
The answer to that is you grow gills.
Yes, because obviously Stephen's running all these tests on Andy, and Andy decides, you know what, we're going to up the ante. So he's like burns his hand over a Bunsen burner, and he's in like an immersion tank, so his ability to stay underwater, the nanobots of the light see that as a weakness, that he can't stay underwater, so, you know, they give him gills. He sees himself as being attacked. He finds that the only way they're going to get rid of the nanobots, or at least attempt to, is through electrocution, so he undergoes electroshock therapy, but the nanobots see that as the body being under attack, so they give him jellyfish skin.
Yeah.
Eyes in the back of his head.
That was a scene where I was like, I don't know where this is going. Is he like growing like additional brain out of the back? That was where I kind of went back to the sixth finger, and it's like, is his brain getting bigger? Because he talks about how he's having these headaches.
Yeah.
And it's like, and then they go and they show back, and then like they show this effect. It's a very startling and effective practical effect where, you know, Steven is sifting through his hair and you see these two things that are kind of like tumors, and he's like, and there's fluid and it's open. It's like, and I'm like, I literally like, holy shit, he's got eyes in the back of his head.
Oh, that was that back when this first aired, that was like such an air punch moment.
Uh-huh.
It was really, sort of like, I mean, what the hell? And yes, I mean, the effects perhaps look a little more dated now, but it's still an effective, a practical effect.
It is. It really is. Like I said, I have never seen this episode, and I did literally exclaim, holy shit.
And this was the thing with the Outer Limits. I mean, there was never any warning of what you were going to get. Each story is standalone, the same as the original series. So
right.
You would enter into each episode not knowing what you're going to get. I mean, it may be a sci-fi tale. It may be a body horror tale. You may just have a straight horror story with such as the episode Under the Bed, which was about the boogeyman. And
right. For
myself, still one of the scariest episodes made of the entire run, but including both original and this reboot. But yeah, I mean, it was nice to go back and watch The New Breed and find that it totally still stood up. I mean, obviously when you watch it as a kid, you don't have a lot of reference points for things. You obviously, unless you've got like very open-minded parents, you won't have seen Cronenberg, for example. And this falls into that Cronenbergian sort of body horror sort of area, really. And with things like The Fly, in particular this idea of the body metamorphs in to become perfect, but obviously what the nanobots conceive as this perfect breed is very different to what we would consider it. So what they're obviously seeing as being improvements, such, you know, giving jellyfish skin so he can't be attacked, giving him extra ribs to protect his major organs.
I mean, there's this one scene where they show an x-ray of a chest x-ray, and it's like they're putting like, wow, Humans are not supposed to have that kind of bone structure. They're doing a number on this guy.
Yeah. It's not a particularly deep episode as such. It's very sort of simple. By the last half of it is really just balls to the wall sort of body horror.
Right.
But I love the fact it takes a simple idea and works it really well. It doesn't feel the need to overcomplicate things. And we have, I mean, it starts off with obviously the fact you have, it makes you sort of question, you know, had Andy not been basically pushing himself, had he not been challenging the nanobots, what state would he have been in? Would he have just been like just a normal guy, just immune to all diseases?
Yeah.
Because obviously the nanobots perceive these tests as being his body being under attack. It's highlighting weakness and,
right.
you know, they want to improve weakness. So that's why they give him gills and the eyes in the back of his head and whatnot. So had he just like, you know, just kept it on the level. I mean, yes, we see him doing things such as he becomes more energetic. He becomes certainly more sexually active with his fiance as we get those wonderful graphic sex scenes. But you have to obviously, it did make me wonder, certainly rewatching it now, how would it have turned out? Because we obviously have the kicker at the end where we find out that his fiance has gained the nanobot's power as he cuts her finger and, oh, it's miraculously healed itself.
Yeah.
Is she going to turn into a freak? Is she going to just, like, be normal? Because as far as Steven's concerned, the nanobot's experiment's destroyed. It's done with.
Right.
And I particularly love the scene where he's obviously forced to kill his friend because Andy's in pain. He's just like in constant pain from these so-called improvements that he actually opts to kill himself.
At Andy's request.
Yeah.
Andy's, and I thought this was a really kind of affecting scene. Andy's logic being either way he would have died. You know, I it's like either you're going to kill me or, you know, I would have just, if I hadn't done this, I would have been on a death sentence anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, either way, I'm doomed.
And the scene after that, where he's obviously killed his friend, and he goes and destroys his experiment. So he's basically just smashing test tubes on the ground.
Uh-huh.
It's so powerfully affected. This perfect combination of what you're watching and music at the same time. It was just such a great little scene.
Yeah.
It did. I mean, just watching this made me want to go back and rewatch the whole of these new ones to see.
Right.
It brought back memories of it.
You know, and this was very, you know, this was for the most part the two leads played by, with Steven, as I said earlier, played by Richard Thomas, and Andy played by Peter Outerbridge. who was one of those Canadian character actors. Actually, he's something of a leading man in Canada. He did a series that I had watched and would like to do for this show sometime called Regenesis, which was one of those shows I don't really know how to describe, but it was basically like a science procedural.
Yeah.
Where he played the head of a an investigative agency, a multinational investigative agency that was that's kind of like that basically kind of like, you know, investigates like basically like biological anomalies, you know, so things that are kind of science fictiony, and that does actually hold the distinction of being the first. In the first season, his Outer Bridge's daughter. Is played by a 17-year-old Ellen Page. That counts as the first thing I ever saw Ellen Page in. But Outer Bridge is one of those people. He shows up. One of the joys, I think I've said this a couple times, of watching like American-produced shows, a lot of shows in America, they're made with American money, but they're actually produced in and made in Canada.
Yeah.
The X-Files, the relationship with Vancouver being the most obvious one. And one of the joys about that is watching it, a show and seeing like just these, there's this basically like this group of, Canadian character actors will just basically show up in all of these projects. Nicholas Lee is a great example, Krychek from the X-Files, but also Clea Scott, Matt Frewer, Ian Tracy, who did, he was, a second string villain on the second season of Bates Motel.
Robert Picardo, I would add.
William B. Davis, the cigarette-smoking man. And Outer Bridge is one of them. The first time I ever saw him, he was in a... He played an evil immortal in one of the episodes of Highlander, the series. I think he did an X-File. He did a couple episodes of 24 where he tortured Jack Bauer. He was in the Fringe pilot. He had one line in the Fringe pilot where he's the doctor after John Scott is... Olivia's boyfriend is exposed to the virus of the week. He's the doctor that goes and says two lines to Anna Torv in the Fringe pilot. He's somebody that, you know, you'll see if you watch a lot of stuff. And every so often he'll show up in movies too. He's the protagonist, I think, of the fifth Saw movie. I didn't even recognize him because he's generally kind of plays these somewhat cocky characters. But when he's introduced, and also he's like 20 years younger in this episode than I'm used to seeing him. He's so twitchy at the beginning of the episode. You know, he's just taking his glasses off constantly and he's sweaty, you know, and just the transformation, you know, once he finds, because he's been having these back problems, he's not feeling well, and that's the transformation, I thought, was just the way Outer Bridge held himself. There's this, almost this campy moment in the speech where he, you know, goes and he breaks into Stephen's lab and injects himself with the nanites, you know, and then he goes, like, 2 days later to Stephen and says, oh, by the way, yeah, here's what I did. I had cancer and I injected your cure for it. And there's this, it's like, oh yeah, sorry I didn't tell you at the time. And there's this scene where he like runs his hand down his like his midsection, like he's in a music video or something like that. Where it's like, my body feels great. And it's like, you know, it's like he's trying to seduce the camera. And it was like, yeah, that's not even that we only spent like 10 minutes with twitchy Andy. We can see that transformation almost immediately. You know, and just like the scene where he's just basically like power fucking his fiance, you know. I mean, it's hardly subtle or sophisticated, but it is incredibly effective. You know, and it doesn't really need, like I said, I don't think it really needs to be like overly, you know, it doesn't really need to be overly deep. I think it's what a format like this does very well.
Yeah. I mean, I would just obviously touch on the fact that you mentioned, obviously, the fact it featured, obviously, one of Canada's great character actors. The Canadian filming laws, just as a random bit of trivia here for you guys, do specify that in order to film in Canada, you have to cast one Canadian actor in your productions.
Yeah.
Which is why we constantly see these guys turning up in all of these sort of cult shows. It's just mainly because they're like the go-to guys.
Canada has a number of very interesting cultural laws. Like, you know, radio stations in Canada have to play, music stations have to play like at least a certain percentage of the what they of their playlist has to come from Canadian artists. And, you know, it may kind of sound weird, but, you know, keep in mind what gigantic, all-encompassing behemoth they have to the south of them, you know, viz, you know, which is kind of like this sort of hydra, that a kind of cultural hydra that just kind of seems to be just all over the place now. Just like our culture is just kind of like vaguely, like sort of gradually, just for a long time, just seem to be gradually overtaking everything. And, you know, even to the point where it's like, and that's one of the, I think, the positive things that's kind of come out of like kind of like the fracturing of the demographics and where you have all these channels now, is like one of the great things is that things that are made in other countries are no longer, and take place in other countries, are no longer relegated to our public television ghetto, you know, which is, you know, allows things like which allows things like, you know, Orphan Black to become popular over here.
I mean, if you had anything else that you want to bring up about this one?
You know, it's not a whole lot. I mean, it's just, this is a, like I said, this is, you know, just to kind of reiterate what I said about this, this is by no means, I think, any sort of great science or satisfying, like I said, it kind of stands in, this has been our kind of like our mad science theme episode.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, like I said, it doesn't have, this episode doesn't have the sophistication that Rick and Morty does. And I don't really even see in this particular episode, even some of the sophistication that you would get earlier, like the pre-reboot, the black and white series. But the thing about it is, it's I was kind of surprised because I kind of expected to be somewhat kind of cheesy and campy. And certainly it has its pulpier elements. It's elements of where, you know, you kind of see the actors going a little bit over the top. But like I said, it tells the story, I think, very well. It's a classic. You know where things are going to go, you know, in a story like this, because you've seen stories about people who tamper in God's domain and, you know, that are slapped down for it. You know, it's like you're sort of like it's sort of like David Cronenberg's Flowers for Algernon.
Yeah.
You know, It does tell the story very effectively. And like I said, it's one of the things that this particular format, the Outer Limits format, does very well.
Oh, definitely. I think certainly the idea of man playing God was a very popular theme within the Outer Limits, and it's one that's explored throughout several episodes. The fact that this is obviously one of the more cheesy sort of episodes doesn't really reflect the series as a whole, as there are a number of episodes which went a lot deeper, same with the original series.
Right.
When you look at things, episodes such as I, Robot, which takes Aramov's laws of robotics.
Right.
And puts it within the context of this robot called Adam being put on trial for the murder of his creator. And he's basically, the episode follows Leonard Nimoy, who plays this lawyer who has basically got to defend him in court. And hence, like, the fact that because of, obviously, Adam being a robot and the laws of robotics say that he can't kill a human, and it's because of man's tampering, the fact he was being forced into this program, that he was forced, that he accidentally killed his creator. And it's a really great episode, and one that puts some deep thought. There's another one where the president believes that the world is being invaded by these aliens. And as the episode goes on, they're kind of like trying to figure out how they're going to respond. Obviously the twist is they find out that the aliens aren't in fact trying to attack them. The reason that they sound so muffled and stuff is the fact they're underwater and that they're actually trying to help the Earth. But because we've launched attack on them, they're now going to destroy us.
Yeah.
And that was the thing I always loved about The Outer Limits. There was always some interesting twist on it. It wasn't always about the gore and the violence and the sex and all these other things that we weren't getting on other shows, for sure.
Yeah.
The fact that you had a show that could tell, like, interesting stories without feeling the need to dumb it down to the audience. You know, it could be cheesy and fun and have throwaway episodes like The New Breed. It could be serious and more thoughtful with episodes like I, Robot or The Voyage Home. And it was able to switch between those two because the standalone stories each week is a different story.
Right.
So it doesn't have to relate to what came before it. You know, this is, you know, this is like you're picking up a pulpy, like one of those pulpy sort of science fiction serial sort of magazines, like Fantastic Times and whatnot, and just
the Weird Tales.
Weird Tales. That's having this story. You know, this is this in this place. This is a story of man who tries to play God by creating nanobots.
Right.
And gets burned in the fires of creation, as we're told in the ending narration by the control voice, though.
So. Yeah.
But would it make you want to look at more of these episodes?
It already has, actually. I haven't actually gone through any other episodes yet, but it's something that's like, you know, I never really went through. And this is kind of weird that I didn't do it at the time. I don't remember why I did, because I did not, because I was a huge fan, even in 95. I even remember really looking forward to this reboot. I had been a huge fan of the originals, really, you know, since my late teens, you know, renting the two episode compilation tapes from my local video store. And I don't know why it never grabbed me at the time, but it's like, I remember watching when I watched this today, it was like, you know, I think I really might've missed out on something here. And, you know, this might be a good opportunity, you know, to go through and watch some of these, because I definitely am more interested in the, one of the really nice things I think I've seen, you know, I've seen recently is kind of this return of interest, the resurgence of interest in the anthology series format with shows like Black Mirror and Inside Number 9 and from Canada, Darknet, you know, where, you know, you don't need like a season long arc anymore. You can tell these kind of compressed stories that, you know, one and done, and then they can be as satisfying as watching something that goes an entire season or an entire series. And I'm definitely more interested, maybe I'm just that I'm more interested in that kind of format for a show than I was when I was in my early 20s. So, but yeah, it's like the entire series, the entire rebooted series and the original series are on Hulu. Over here in the States, and it's like, this is an opportunity, you know, that I think I'm finally going to take up that opportunity.
I think,
so thank you for actually recommending this.
Yeah, needless to say, I think this isn't going to be our last visit by any means to the Outer Limits, so you can look forward to us looking at more episodes from both the original series and the new series on future episodes of the show. That obviously brings us to the end of another episode of TV Good Sleep Bad. Next episode is episode 12, and also the marks our 1 year anniversary of hanging out here in the basement, watching the old TV shows, and you know, basically trying to get more people to latch onto our love of these weird and obscure shows that we obviously obsess about on this monthly show. So, but Lucky, what have you selected for next episode?
I had a short list. I think I've mentioned it several times of like shows in particular episodes that I've wanted to do. And one of the ones series that I really decided when we first started doing this is I want to do an episode of The Prisoner. I could never figure out which one. And now that we are just basically going through just complete and utter electoral process chaos, both on my side of the Atlantic and on yours with, you know, with the whole Brexit fiasco, really, I think that the episode we have no other choice than to cover the Patrick McGoohan scathing satire of democracy, an episode entitled "Free for All," in which Patrick McGoohan's number six, not to be confused with Battlestar Galactica's number six, runs for the position of number two, with predictably bizarre results, as always happened on The Prisoner. So,
nice.
The Prisoner, basically.
That's fine. For myself, we're going to be looking at another show that we've long sort of muted over saying that we're going to do an episode from, and that's we're going to be looking at an episode of Masters of Horror. The episode we're going to be focusing on is also going to be on a political edge, so it's going to be a very politically charged anniversary episode for sure, and we're going to be looking at the episode Homecoming, in which the dead of various wars decide to rise from their graves and go up against the government. So it's going to be, I think, a very political show, but I think it's also going to be a very interesting show with these two very different takes on political satire, for sure. It's looking like another fun show next month.
Yeah, we're here to offend somebody that we haven't already offended so far with this episode, talking about people turning into jellyfish and child rape, so...
Indeed.
TV, good sleep, bad people, your choice for jellyfish people and child molestation.
Obviously, in the meantime, you can follow us on Facebook, just type in TV, good sleep, bad. We're also on Twitter, which is at TV, good sleep, bad. Thank you again also to the guys over at Jess Archer Versus for leaving us some very nice comments on the Twitter feed. We are in the process at the moment, trying to, in talks to getting them on the show and hopefully subjecting them to some fun cool viewing as well. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, though, please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, hit that subscribe button on iTunes, and maybe leave us some nice comments or just your thoughts generally on the show. We'd love to hear what you obviously think. But
we live for the validation of our peers.
But until next time, I obviously like to thank my co-host as always, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
You're welcome. Can do.
And I've been Elwood Jones, and remind you as always to keep it strange.